Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Dorit Rosler, who was a female doctor, when they asked about, would have you done the same to your daughter if your daughter were an athlete? And she said, yeah, probably I would have done it.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. In the early 1970s, the athletes of East Germany started to achieve incredible sports results, winning medals and setting new world records with astonishing frequency. For many years, their sporting supremacy was hailed as a triumph of the socialist government's commitment to scientific research and innovative training methods. However, after the Cold War ended, the Stasi archives revealed a sinister secret behind the successes. A perverse doping system imposed by the government itself. Drugs were administered to young athletes, often without their consent, and the price their bodies are now paying is very high, both physically and mentally. I talked with Joseph Tudor, the author of a new book called Synthetic Medals, which reveals the events that led to the discovery of the state doping system and the subsequent trial. It also explores the state's motives for this crime against its own people. You can buy the book via the links in the episode notes and help support the podcast. The Cold War conversation continues in our vibrant Facebook discussion group and on Twitter. Just search for Cold War Conversations on Facebook, and we're at Cold War Pod on Twitter. Now, Cold War history is disappearing, but a simple monthly donation will help keep this podcast on the air. You'll be part of our community, you'll get a sought-after Cold War Conversations coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history.
Hi, I'm Sean from Perth, Western Australia, and I support the Cold War Conversations podcast because these are the real stories of the world I grew up in.
If a monthly contribution is not your cup of tea, we also welcome one-off donations via coldwarconversations.com/donate. I'm delighted to welcome Joseph Tudor to our Cold War conversation.
After the Second World War, Germany was split into two countries, and the eastern part was controlled by the Soviet Union. Control of Soviet Union was so oppressive that in the end, the new government couldn't actually decide anything without the approval of the Soviet Union. At some point, they realized that the only way they had to put themselves on the map was sport. So they checked out with Stalin first, of course, and Stalin didn't care much about sports. So they say, so he said, okay, that's fine. You can do whatever you like with sports, no problems with that. So they did. And the first thing to do was to nationalize all the sports clubs. The government tried to encourage its citizens to enroll in sports clubs and to be active, to be fit. And it wasn't easy because obviously we are talking about the late 40s. So the country was still devastated by the war, and it wasn't an easy task. But they were so determined that they succeeded to build eventually the best sports recruitment system in the world, possibly. Let's not forget that they only had 15 million people, and they managed to produce a lot of sports champions.
So they're trying to improve their profile on the world stage through sport. At what point do they start looking at artificial methods to improve their athletes' performance?
After they started to build the Olympic movement, because of obviously that was something that every country took for granted, having an Olympic committee, but it wasn't the same for East Germany. And they formed one, but took many years before it was actually approved by the International Olympic Committee. Once that happened, they started to compete internationally. At some point, they realized that doping was one of the ways that could help to achieve a certain success. But that obviously wasn't the only means. The other part was to create a recruitment system, first of all. And once they had the raw material in speech marks, that was young people, young teenagers, obviously they needed to train them, and they had to make sure that they were fit enough to become competitors on the international scene. There was another means that had to create the difference between them and other athletes. So they tried to enhance their performance with drugs, and they tried amphetamines first, and eventually steroids. Steroids were the drugs that they decided to use, and testosterone was the one that they went for in the end. They used it for many, many years. And one of the advantages was that it was not a forbidden substance at that time. We're talking about the 50s, the 60s. And so they could use it without any problem. Obviously, the International Olympic Committee warned the nations not to use drugs, but they didn't have at that time any real method to find out if they would use drugs or not. So it was just a sort of moral stance, but nothing else. So the East German government took advantage of this. That was up to, in 1972, where they started to find ways to detect testosterone, and then things changed. But East Germany was able to adapt very quickly, as we'll see.
I mean, as well as the drugs, their training regime was quite unique as well, wasn't there? There was a lot of science and focus on the training. Obviously, the drugs helped, but the training was really effective as well of the athletes.
Yeah, the training was second to none. It was one of the best in the world, because they spent a lot of money to create DHFK. It was a sort of university of physical education, and they were probably the only country in the world to have such institution. Obviously, recruitment started at an early age, and once people were scouted, they went into these schools. They were special schools where students could study and do sport at the same time. Sometimes they would allow students to study one or two extra years, because obviously they would dedicate time to, I don't know, literature or maths or science. The time for these subjects was inferior, obviously, and so they could catch up with them by remaining in a school a couple of extra years. Then they had machines that today we take for granted when we go and visit a gym, but at that time they were quite extraordinary, state-of-the-art equipment. They had computers, they had slow-motion recorders, they were able to detect all the errors that an athlete could do in during training, so they could fix those errors. They also had a swimming channel where water would flow in the opposite direction as motion of the swimmer. And that was incredibly tiring. The athletes described this as a torture, but it was incredibly effective at enhancing the technique of these swimmers. So it wasn't just the drugs. It was also incredibly advanced system that East Germany alone created. Other countries obviously looked at the East German system with envy. They managed to send some journalists, and there were quite a few that had the possibility to visit these facilities in Leipzig, in Dresden, in Berlin, and they reported what they saw, obviously, and they were quite enthusiastic. And these were reporters from the most advanced countries, from Canada. From Doug Gilbert, for instance, he wrote a book on the East German system. He called it the miracle machine. So these journalists came from countries that were, they competed against these German athletes. They were supposed to win, but they lost all the time, and they wanted to know why that happened. So yes, technology was probably the first thing that created the East German athlete phenomenon. And I would say that drugs improved it, but that was the very first thing. Without the investment in technology, the East German miracle wouldn't have happened.
The story of Doug Gilbert is an interesting one that you feature in the book. People will have to buy the book to hear how fascinating that aspect of the story is. But the book's full of pieces of information that I had no knowledge about, and some fascinating stories of the background behind the East German sort of athlete machine, really, it was, of producing these incredible athletes. But one of the things I wanted to ask you was, when did East Germany make their first breakthrough as far as medal success? When did they start to appear to be winning more than they had before?
Yeah, initially they weren't allowed to take part in Olympic Games by themselves. So they, the International Olympic Committee, they want them to take part with Germany, with West Germany together as a sort of unified Germany team. This was something that irritated the two countries. They didn't want that, but at that time, it was the best, according to the IOC, was the best thing to do. And this carried on for years in the 60s. And the first time that East Germany was allowed to compete by itself, it was at the Olympics in Mexico in 1968. They could compete by themselves, and they managed to grab quite a few medals. I think it was a 9 gold medals, so they got first time. And there was also the moment where they tried to present an athlete that was completely gone under the so-called state doping. They chose Margita Gummel, who was a shot putter, and in a matter of months, they helped her to improve her performance by something like 2 meters. And she won gold medal. She set a new world record, and she was a sort of guinea pig for the sports system. And the experiment was clearly a success. And after they realized that the way they used the doping was the correct one, and so they started using it extensively with other athletes. Very often, the athletes didn't know they were taking drugs, especially those who were very young. And later, in 1972, there was probably the explosion of East Germany, especially in swimming. They won so many medals, and then 4 years later in Montreal, 1976, they established themselves as the leading nations. They came, I think, second behind the Soviet Union in the medal table so many times. And most importantly for them, they came before West Germany and the United States. This was quite extraordinary for a country, as we said before, that had only 17 million people, depending on the decade. And the merit of these was, I think, the incredible organizational skills of the sports ministry and obviously the doping itself. It was a combination of the two. Then, of course, as we know, they couldn't compete in Los Angeles because of the boycott. And then in Seoul was the last time in 1988, the last time they took part in the Olympic Games.
I think one of the most interesting facts that I saw in the book, that even after East Germany had reunified with West Germany, there was a Barcelona Olympics that for the unified Germany, 60% of the medals were won by former GDR athletes who were presumably not taking drugs at that point. Which sort of proves the effectiveness of that training regime, I imagine.
Yes, it is a period that it was described by journalists at that time as a period above suspicion, because obviously now we had the unified Germany, United Germany, and whatever suspect there was on East German success, it all of a sudden disappeared. I remember that because at that time I was a teenager. And I remember that East German athletes, they won all the time, obviously. But occasionally you had some journalists, some pundits to talk about how weird certain women appeared. They looked like male, and obviously they discussed their performance. The fact that they set world record after world record was suspicious at some point. But there weren't any accusations, because obviously East Germany was they were very clever at never failed a doping test. And so eventually all the suspects evaporated. But when they compete, these athletes went to compete for East Germany, and we're talking about athletes such as Heike Drechsler, for instance, a very famous one. She was from East Germany, and then she competed for Germany. She won so many medals afterwards, but nobody said anything about her. And or the other athletes. So the Germany wins. So they were considered clean, and there weren't any suspicion at all. So this went on for many years until the truth came out.
With East Germany's success, unusual success, there must have been suspicions with the IOC and others about why they were suddenly becoming so successful.
There are suspicions, and the first thing the IOC did was to create a proper system to counteract doping. They knew that not just East Germany, but the doping was more and more diffused between athletes, and one of the problem was that at some point people started to feel sick and die because of doping. So let's say that until all the 1960s, the IOC didn't didn't do much, maybe also because there wasn't, I don't know, the proper technology. They didn't have enough money to invest in the technology able to detect drugs. But at some point, when athletes started to feel sick and die, they decided that the time came to actually check these athletes out and see if they took something. So they did, and first time they started to check on athletes was in the Giro d'Italia, the cycling race, and
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War, because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Got some out. From them, they moved on to the Olympics in Mexico, 1968. And they started to suspend athletes because they were positive to certain drugs. After that, with the explosion of the East German athletes, there were suspicions that they were taking drugs, and obviously there were some athletes who defected from East Germany. They went to West Germany and they told stories of doping, but they weren't believed at the time. IOC did everything they could, obviously, but the East German government was very well prepared to counteract this. And as soon as they used better machines, better technology to detect drugs, they suspended training for a while and try to find new ways without being found out after competitions. And they decided not to send athletes if they thought they might be caught. And after that, they developed some strategies and they developed the right technology. They bought a very expensive Hewlett-Packard machine, a gas spectrometer, and they were able to detect any infinitesimal substance of doping in their own athletes. And they knew that if the urine presented any trace of doping, they wouldn't go to compete. They would stay home. So everything was planned. There was in the history of East German sports, only one athlete was caught. It was quite extraordinary. They didn't expect that. And when that happened, they took countermeasures, obviously. Until the end of the collapse of East Germany, no athlete was ever caught at doping tests. So, yeah.
Were they using this in other sports other than athletics and swimming? So, for example, in football and other sports, were they using these techniques?
In East Germany, the most popular sport was actually football. They are East German athletes. They're famous. They are known for their performances in athletics and swimming and gymnastics. But football was still sport number one for fans and supporters, as it was the same in West Germany. Let's not forget that East Germany, it was still a country made of Germans, and they had the same culture, the same traditions. So they love football. There were cases in which football players confessed that they took drugs. Regarding football, oddly enough, the sports minister didn't like much for football players to take drugs, because football is a kind of different sport where maybe creativity counts more than doping. It's something that doping can't really help you with, and so they didn't want football players to take drugs unless they were involved in international football matches. So all the UEFA matches, they were allowed to take there, but otherwise in domestic competitions, so the Oberliga, which was the equivalent of the Premier League in East Germany, they didn't like that. And at some point, there was also a black market of testosterone growing in East Germany, and the authorities did everything to stop it. So it is incredible that the country that promoted doping at some point decided to stop it, because it wasn't. They understood it wasn't really necessary at that time, and this is what they did. But yeah, to answer your question, so yeah, absolutely, it was present. The distribution wasn't exactly like the one for athletics or swimming athletes. That was a proper state-sponsored doping program. There wasn't one for football.
So in football, it was more like individual players sourcing drugs,
yes,
and using them. So it wasn't like the whole team would be drugged, for example.
Yes, it might happen, and there are some there's some evidence in the Stasi archives where at some point in some international football matches, the entire national team took drug. But yes, there aren't many declassified documents that expose these. So yeah, we can say that drug, of course, was there as well, as evidence shows, but not as the same extent as in other sports.
The football side particularly interested me, because obviously you've got FC Magdeburg, who won the Cup Winners' Cup in 1974. But I found their manager really interesting, is that he was actively resisting the Stasi trying to help them win that, because I think the Stasi had put bugs in the opposition's dressing room and were going to offer the recordings to Magdeburg's manager. And he said, no, I don't want them. If we're going to win, we're going to do this fairly. But I think it was pretty much a career-ending moment sort of for him, because they got rid of him in the next year or so, I think. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was Heinz Krugel. Yeah, he was Magdeburg's manager and quite popular person in East Germany. And yeah, as you mentioned, he refused to spy on other players. I think they were Bayern Munich players. He refused to spy on the manager, and eventually he was fired. But yeah, the East German, the Stasi was patient, and they waited the right time to fire him, or to have him fired, because he was a very successful manager, and he was loved by everyone, and so they had to wait until he got unlucky moment, a series of negative results, and they say they got rid of him. Then he couldn't find a job after that, and he remained unemployed virtually for the rest of his career. Then when the Berlin Wall fell, he was rehabilitated, and he eventually got a managerial job again with Magdeburg and till he died. And yes, there is a he was the most successful manager for Magdeburg and in East Germany, actually. And they dedicated a statue to him. And in Magdeburg, there's in front of the stadium, there is a quite nice statue of him holding the Cup Winners' Cup. Yeah, he won against AC Milan. Quite an achievement, because AC Milan was a very strong side.
One of the Italian sides was trying to get him as a manager.
Yeah, it was a Juventus.
Juventus, okay.
Yeah, Juventus tried to sign him, and they also wanted Martin Hoffmann, who was a Magdeburg striker. At that time, it was very difficult anyway for a player from the Eastern Bloc to go and play in the West. As far as I can remember, we didn't have Russian players or Bulgarian players playing in in the Premier League or First Division or Serie A. We had to wait to the 1990s, 1991, before seeing this player. So I don't know if it was technically possible to have a manager from East Germany working in Turin. But if they tried, it was probably possible.
Fascinating, fascinating. So, I mean, the fall of the Berlin Wall is a good point for us to talk about Baron Donk and Franke and their work in terms of starting to uncover what had actually gone on in East Germany.
We can say they are the heroes of the story, you might say. Brigitte Berendonck was an East German athlete who defected in the early 60s. So she went to live in West Germany. At some point, she met Werner Franke, who is a professor of molecular biology. So he is an expert in chemistry. And together, they developed a sort of theory. According to Brigitte Berendonck, obviously there was doping circulating in East Germany, and that was the worst kind, because it was a state doping. She didn't have any evidence. She tried to gather evidence. She tried to interview athletes who defected from the East. But that, of course, wasn't hard evidence. She needed documents. Werner Franke, from the scientific point of view, tried to study the phenomenon and try to understand and explain what testosterone can do to people, and why athletes would use testosterone. So there were a few publications during the 70s and the 80s that were quite extraordinary for that time. But again, there wasn't really any evidence to accuse the East German system. With the fall of the Berlin Wall, it was possible for them to access the Stasi archives. It wasn't easy, because the bureaucrats of the ministry, they tried to destroy as much documents as they could, and they succeeded in doing that. But at some point, Werner Franke and Brigitte Berendonck, they found a sort of secret it was a secret place, it was in a military hospital where they had copies of the documents that were destroyed by the Stasi that were in the center at the, in Berlin. They found a lot of interesting materials. They found names of athletes, they found names of doctors, politicians involved with the state doping. At that point, state doping had a name. It was called a Staatsplanthema. Staatsplanthema means state plan. So what they did was to administer drugs, testosterone mainly, to young athletes. And all of these was documented, was recorded. Then Brigitte Berendonck took this material and published a book. The book, of course, was quite sensational because for the first time it revealed the truth behind the success of the East German athletes. The fact that they published this book and the fact that there were also some prominent doctors, physicians, managers, trainers started to confess what they did during the 70s and the 80s. And they encouraged the German justice to set up a trial. So eventually in 1997, they started the so-called doping process, which was a doping trial. So in 3 years, 1997 to 2000, the German justice and Franke and Berendonck, they managed to interview all these people, and the confessions are quite extraordinary in the book. There are so many examples of them. Some, of course, try to deny what they were doing, or some admitted they what they did, but they justify themselves saying that they were just following orders, you know, the usual excuse.
Yeah, we've heard that before, haven't we, somewhere? Can't remember
yes.
where.
So eventually, the funny thing with the trial, the doping process, was that eventually it wasn't possible to send anyone to jail because there was a big legal problem. It wasn't a crime in East Germany. So in East Germany, it was legal. It was sponsored by the government. So how could they put on trial such people? So there was a quite interesting legal aspect. So eventually they decided to do the trial anyway, but the main responsible, the main people responsible were just condemned to fine, to pay a fine and nothing else. And it was impossible to put the leading politicians on trial. So, they just were able to dock people involved with the sports aspect of the doping. So the sports ministry, of course, was there, and all physicians involved with the university in Leipzig, and of course a lot of trainers were there. There were the incredible stories of all the athletes that testified, and they told their stories, and all stories are quite extraordinary. They're sad stories, obviously, but I believe it was only fair to make these stories available to a wider public.
Yeah, and they are incredible stories. As Joseph says, some of them are incredibly sad. Some of them are powerful stories of trying to resist the drugs regime. And the fact that they were giving these to really young athletes, and they were putting pressure on the parents as well, weren't they? Because once you were in this program, it wasn't very easy to leave.
Yes. Although we have to say that the situations could be different depending on the place, on the sports club, on the people involved, but there was an aspect that was quite interesting, because once these teenagers showed that they were medal material, they were quite precious, and the sports club tried everything to enhance their performances. They didn't want them to leave. They obviously communicated a lot with parents because they believed that they are unhappy child wouldn't perform well. So they were convinced that the parents' approval was something necessary. However, having said that, sometimes it happened that the child wasn't happy for different reasons. The training regime was quite harsh and some teenagers couldn't bear it and they wanted to leave at some point, but they weren't allowed. So the establishment started to threaten the families. Families would get some bonuses because of the children's performances, such as a better flat, maybe, or a Trabant, or better salary, a better job position. So they were sort of weird trade going on, and all these things might disappear overnight if the child decided to withdraw from the sports club. Sometimes this didn't happen. Sometimes you could have a child leaving the sports club and nothing would happen to his or her parents, but there were consequences for parents, and in some cases, as we can see in the book, there were some the whole family suffered the consequences of an athlete leaving the sports club or even defecting to West Germany. The mom and sisters and brothers are losing their job and losing their social position overnight. So it was quite difficult for these people.
Probably the most devastating side of this is the side effects that these drugs were having on the athletes as well. I mean, I found that particularly shocking as to the doctors and many of the trainers who were administering these or giving these young people and older athletes these drugs were aware of what the side effects would be, but in the pursuit of gold medals for East Germany, continued to use these.
Yeah, this was one of the lines of defense strategies at the trial, but it didn't last because the side effects of testosterone. Side effects were known since the 60s, so they were in the medicine books, so there really wasn't an excuse. And among the side effects, we can have liver problems, for instance, this one quite common. Then problems with the heart, cardiac arrhythmia was another one. And there were also problems with the genitals. Girls, they could have some unusual growth of the genitals, and that led to sometimes to a kind of weird sexual drive. So also psychological, so testosterone causes psychological problems because, of course, that makes people more aggressive. It's not the same for all people, but most girls experience that. It was a bit different for boys, but as we have seen, a lot of boys who then after years they suffered the consequences of that, and there were some people developed prostate cancer, testicular cancer, liver cancer. Percentage of these conditions in athletes is much higher than the average citizen, so there must be a link between the doping and these conditions. That's why it is sad, because so many people today suffer the consequences of something that they didn't even ask for. Many athletes were not aware they were taking drugs. Some children started to take drugs when they were 11 or 12. And at that age, you don't even know the difference between testosterone and sugar. You don't even know what these things are. And they were told that they were getting vitamins, something not harmful, obviously. Only at a certain age, usually 18, 2015, some athletes would come to know, or they would reveal to them they were taking some form of doping, but they would never disclose what kind of doping that was. So it was difficult to live once you have been there for many, many years, and especially if you reached glory by winning medals. But some people did, as we see in the book, someone like Cornelia Ender, who was very successful athlete. Was one of the most important athletes at the Montreal Olympics. As soon as she found out she was taking drugs, she left her sports club straight away and didn't want to have anything to do with sports anymore. And she was quite famous in the Western world. And like Cornelia Ender, many did the same thing. So there are different stories. It depends really on the person, on the personality, on life conditions, social conditions. Some athletes decided to carry on. They suspected they were taking drugs, but they didn't care. They just wanted the benefits, the bonuses. They wanted to become famous, whilst others ignore completely they were taking drugs. So there's a whole spectrum of situations here.
So there were some athletes that actively didn't take drugs in the East German system, or was it almost compulsory?
There were cases where some managers, some trainers refused to administer drugs to their athletes, because eventually this came from the top, obviously. It was an order that went down in a pyramidal fashion, and at the base of the pyramid there was the trainer. The trainer was the one who eventually had to administer the drugs, some of them refused and they lost their job. Others, most of them decided to carry on. And so from that point of view, there are also some interesting stories, because it is a matter of conscience at the end of the day. There's at a trial, there's Dorit Rosler, who was a female doctor. Well, this the only female doctor actually present at the trial. And she knew what she was doing, but when they asked about, what have you done the same to your daughter, if your daughter were an athlete? And she said, I would have done it, because at that time we were so compelled to do it, so confused. I mean, it was an order from above, and it was difficult to rebel. Essentially, this is what happens in a regime. After all, they create a system of paranoia, a system of fear, and it is very difficult for an individual to resist. But even in such difficult period, there were quite a few people who resisted, and they paid the consequences for that. And I talk about them in the book, and they're quite very interesting stories.
They are. There's an endless number of interesting stories. I mean, we have literally just scratched the surface of what's in the book. Joseph, one of the things that I find fascinating is the legacy of the East German athletic success still exists today. There are still world records that have not been beaten that were set by East German athletes. I always am amazed that whenever I'm watching the Olympics or some other athletic competition, they always come up with the women's 400 meters record of Marita Koch, which was set as an East German and is still there. I find that just incredible that's not been beaten. But presumably that was set through performance-enhancing drugs.
According to the Stasi documents, Marita Koch and others, they were in the list. So obviously we can assume that it was something chemical involved. And it is strange that we see. Obviously, the Marita Koch's record is not the only long-standing record. For example, Florence Griffith, 200 meters, is also quite out of this world and still standing. We have to say also that Marita Koch was an incredible athlete. She was able to run the 100 meters, 200 meters, 400 meters with record-breaking times. This is one of the aspects that might puzzle us, there wasn't any doping at all, would this athlete be able to perform the same way they did? And this is what the question Rika Reinisch, a swimmer, she won two gold medals in Moscow. And she always asked herself these. I won two gold medals and a lot of other accolades, but would it have been the same if they didn't give me drugs? And it is a really fascinating question, because you can never know the answer to that. Obviously, can only speculate. But in one of the chapters of my book, I analyzed this aspect. And this probably was one of the most interesting things to me from this story. We now have this idea that East German athletes, of course, cheated and they won so many medals because they took drugs and so on. And obviously, this is true because there are documents, there was a trial, it has been established as true. However, not all athletes might have taken drugs. And there's evidence that some athletes were competed in a clean way. There is no evidence in the Stasi archives that these people took drugs. And we are talking about people who were constantly monitored. For example, Katarina Witt, she was a famous skater, ice skater, and she was constantly monitored because she was famous in the West, and Stasi was afraid that she might defect any moment. And she was controlled by secret agents, and there are details even on her sexual life, but there's nothing, not a thing about doping. So that's quite interesting. It means that she didn't take any. We'll never know the truth, but these things should be considered. And I sort of play the devil's advocate in the book and try to see if it is possible to rehabilitate some of the East German athletes and not putting all of them in the same basket of drugged cheaters people. But there were people, there were trainers that refused to give drugs to the athletes. So it must be athletes that they didn't take doping and they competed fairly. And it is something that should be explored in more detail, I think.
Yeah, because you've got to have some ability anyway, because it's not as though you could give me a load of steroids and I'd be able to run a world record 100 meters. I'd probably barely run 20 meters, to be honest. You know, you've got to have that natural ability. And I think, you know, this is what I was saying at the start around the training and the science that went behind the training helped the East Germans win. And the drugs also helped to some degree, but we'll never really know to what degree they did. Bring in things like 47 gold medals in Moscow. Admittedly, the US weren't competing that year. Winter Olympics in Sarajevo, top of the medals table. Calgary, second in the medals table. Phenomenal, as you say, for a country of that size, but we'll never really be able to determine how much of that success was through to drugs and or whether it was through to, you know, natural ability and a really efficient training program.
Yes, the quick answer is that, yeah, we'll never know.
Exactly. Yeah, that was me saying it the real long way around, and you've summarized it beautifully, Joseph. Thank you.
Yes, it's we can only speculate, as I do in the book, and there's a chapter dedicated to this. And what I want to make clear is this, that although, yeah, we will never know, but I want people to consider seriously the possibility that there were East German athletes that won fairly without cheating, without taking drugs, because there is evidence for that. And I really don't like the fact that they all have to be considered cheaters, because this is not true.
That's an interesting aspect, and I think not an aspect that people would have necessarily been aware of. So appreciate mm-hmm. you sharing that. Did any East German athletes hand back their medals?
Yes, quite a few. There were some dramatic testimonies at the trial where some athletes actually took their medals and threw them on the floor, and they say that they refused the medal. They wanted to give it back to the FINA or the IAF or the IIF or whatever, because they don't deserve it, because it was won because of doping. But obviously, these are people who are sick because of doping, and of course, for them, it's difficult to accept even a gold medal at the Olympics, which is something extraordinary. They just can't see that they don't want it in their house. They just they throw it away because they linked it to the health condition. Although they did achieve what they achieved through determination to endless hours of training. And let's not forget that, yes, as you mentioned before, doping alone can't help you. And this is an interesting question. It's a philosophical question. You can argue endlessly without reaching a conclusion. But it is something that I like to explore in the book, because obviously you train like crazy. You for years you live away from your family. You can't eat ice cream. You can't eat this. You can't do that. Some of the trainers can be also difficult, and there was bullism and sort of lots of different situations. And then you finally win a medal, and then after 20 years, they tell you, "No, sorry, that medal is not yours. So you didn't win it fairly because they gave you doping." Some athletes, they said, okay, yeah, maybe I took drugs, but I deserve my medals because I trained hard for years, and so that's it. And they don't want to discuss it anymore. Others, they throw the medals away. So again, we have the whole spectrum of situations. Others, they just remain silent and don't say anything, and they carry on with a normal life. It's really interesting.
It's a fascinating book. It's been a real revelation for me. So the book is called Synthetic Medals, East German Athletes' Journey to Hell. It's published by Pitch Publishing. If you're at all interested in East Germany or sports history, it is a fascinating read. I learned a lot from this book. So it's definitely Cold War Conversations recommended. You can buy the book and help support the podcast via the links in the episode notes. Don't miss the episode extras such as videos, photos, and other content. Just look for the link in the podcast information. The podcast wouldn't exist without the generous support of our financial supporters, and I'd like to thank one and all of them for keeping the podcast on the road. If you'd like to help the project, just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. The Cold War Conversation continues in our Facebook discussion group. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thanks very much for listening, and see you next week. not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.